we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's move on, starting with local and Olympia.
Yeah, finally, after months of squabbling, they reached a budget compromise this week on the budget in Olympia. And somewhat surprisingly, given that Republicans have been driving the narrative on this ever since their budget coup a couple of months ago, the budget compromise that came out pretty much went the Democrats' way. It avoided the education and social service cuts that were in the Senate Republican budget. Almost entirely. The Republicans got about a quarter of what they wanted on cuts to the state pension plan, which was one of the big things they were pushing for, to punish, state employees, similar to what was done in Wisconsin and other Republican-dominated states. And there were, the flip side of this, something that neither side was particularly pushing for, but, the Republicans were particularly insistent on it. There was almost no new revenue in the package. So it still wound up being an almost all cuts budget, but it did manage to, save most of the, already decimated funding on education and social services. So that was the good news. The bad news, of course, is that they're going to go around and go through all this again next year and every year thereafter until they do any kind of meaningful tax reform, because the way the state tax structure is structurally, you're going to keep having these shortfalls even if the economy improves. The state is particularly vulnerable to downturns because it's so reliant on sales taxes, but even without that particular reliance, the way it's structured, it's, as we move to a more service economy, it is taxing less and less of the state's economy each year, and that over time means almost guarantees budget shortfall. So this is going to be a structural problem until we adapt some form of income tax or some other major structural reform that takes us away from reliance on sales taxes.
Like closing tax loopholes?
That would be an excellent one, too. There was one tax loophole that was actually closed. The only real there were actually two relatively minor revenue increases. One was a tax on rolled cigarette papers, which, you know, isn't going to amount to too much. And then the other, however, was a closing of a loophole on big bank tax credits. Out-of-state bank tax credits. So that was good news. But where that loophole is gone, there are literally hundreds of other loopholes that are still there.
All right. Moving on, another proposal out this week from Seattle City Councilman Nick Licata.
No, this wasn't from Nick Licata. Oh. We talked a couple weeks ago about a proposal that Nick put out around rental inspections. That in turn was a response to the initial proposal that was put out by Seattle's Department of Planning and Development. Now there is a third proposal that is out on rental inspections. This one came from the Washington Multifamily Housing Association, which represents the owners of large apartment buildings in Seattle. They offered a version that is pretty close to the DPD, that is the city original proposal, farther away from Licata's counterproposal. The complaint that Licata had for the original DPD proposal was that it was, well, a couple of things. Number one, it didn't inspect all units. Licata's proposal had a 10-year plan to inspect all rental units in Seattle at least once during a given decade. But other than that, the other major complaint was that it was a complaint-based system where there would be inspections when there were complaints to the city. And, you know, a lot of people don't complain to the city because they fear reprisals from their landlord, or they don't know that they can complain to the city or for other reasons like that. Well, the Multifamily Housing Association proposal would, as with the DPD model, would not involve going into the into most of the units themselves. They're drive-by inspections. It deprioritizes random inspections, putting them on the bottom of a list of pools of properties inspected in order based on the seriousness of complaints that the city has received. So again, it's a complaint-based system. The Housing Owners Association proposal also includes a specific list of violations inspectors should search for, rather than searching for, you know, all types of violations. And it deprioritizes large buildings, and I love this part because according according to the Large Building Owners Trade Association, those units are professionally managed and therefore less likely to have violations. Now, the reason I bring this up is it's a really good example of how our democracy is working, that here you have a legislative proposal that will presumably be taken seriously by the city council coming from the trade association for the industry that is going to be regulated. Not only that, but it deprioritizes the large buildings that are owned by the people who dominate that trade association. In other words, they're not only making a legislative proposal for their own industry, but they're doing it in such a way to give a competitive advantage to the people who dominate the trade association at the expense of their rivals in the industry who own fewer or smaller buildings. This is our democracy in action, and let's hope this proposal doesn't go too far in city council for that reason, if no other.
Well, they must have some good lobbyists, I guess.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that going around.
Yeah. All right, moving on, a slight change in the race for the first congressional district.
Yeah, instead of having six Democrats in the first congressional district race, the seat that was filled by Jay Inslee, but now with the new district, is essentially a brand new district because it doesn't bear much geographic resemblance after redistricting to the district that Inslee had. It goes all the way from the east side of Seattle around Kirkland and Woodinville and such, all the way north to the Canadian border, while somehow managing to skip Everett and Bellingham. So instead of having six Democrats in that race, there are now five. State Representative Roger Goodman, who has really made a name for himself over the past few years around championing medical marijuana and trying to alleviate the worst abuses of the war on drugs, has dropped out of the race. That leaves Darcy Berner, Laura Rudderman, Susan DelBene, several other Democrats that are still scrambling to fill that, as well as one Republican, a Tea Party favorite named John Koester, who ran against Rick Larson in 2010. Koester, Berner, and DelBene have all run for Congress before. That primary is going to be very crowded. Goodman, by dropping out at this point, reserves his right. He'll be running for higher office again sometime, sure. He's got a lot of fans and has done a lot of good work. The Democrats that are still in the race, several of them are still very good, but it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out.
All right, moving on to national, and starting with developments this week with the Trayvon Martin case.
Yeah, George Zimmerman charged with second-degree murder by the prosecutor that was appointed by the state of Florida to look into the case this week. You figure there must be fairly significant evidence for the second-degree murder charge, not only that George Zimmerman's story of firing in self-defense after Martin attacked him, that story was false or at least had significant problems with it, but that voice that was heard screaming on 9/11 tapes, as a number of independent voice analysts have said, was definitively Trayvon Martin pleading for his life, and that the officer report by the Sanford Police Department officer who initially took Zimmerman's statement was a false report. That it had a number of elements in it that in order for this affidavit filed by the prosecutor to be true, would have had to be false. So it's going to be very interesting to see if there's going to be any accountability for the failure to arrest Martin at the scene when it was obvious that he had done the shooting, the failure to secure the crime scene, et cetera, et cetera. It sounds an awful lot like what happened initially in this case was not racially motivated per se in terms of the police and prosecutorial conduct. It was Zimmerman's father, who's a former magistrate, getting on the phone with the state prosecutor in the case, who has since recused himself for reasons that have not been released, but they're old friends apparently, and saying, you know, look, well, my boy got in trouble again. He flies off the handle like that, and his friend, the prosecutor, saying, "Oh, no problem. We'll take care of that." And suddenly the charges were dropped, and in the small town South, and I can say that as somebody who was in the South this week visiting family, That is still how it works sometimes. So that isn't necessarily a race per se, although the lack of interest in trying to identify the body and notify the family is pretty disturbing. And we'll probably never know whether that was an issue of race, whether that was an issue of trying to, delay any kind of, accountability so they could, they could find a way to justify the lack of an arrest in the case, what it is. But assuming this case actually does go to trial, it's going to be very interesting to see what is said and what is not said about the police and prosecutorial misconduct in this case, which is what made it an international case. It wasn't just the fact that a cop wannabe on neighborhood watch shot at an unarmed black kid. That kind of tragedy, while terrible, it does not make for an international story all by itself. It was the lack of official response that did that. And whether that's going to be any kind of accountability for that particular official response, we'll see. The prosecutor in the case this week, while she was announcing the affidavit, went out of her way to try and defend the police department and the official response so far. But there's also a federal investigation, actually a couple federal investigations looking into this as well. So we'll see what kind of action they take.
All right. Moving on, tangential to that, the developments in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, well, I was talking with my mother in Georgia this week about, she mentioned that boy Tyrone down in Florida and how they were trying to make it all about race. And then she was talking about the shootings in Tulsa this past weekend and how they were trying to make that about race. And guess what? It was about race. They wound up arresting two guys, Jake Inland and Alvin Watch, charged with 5 shootings, including 3 deaths, when they rode around the black section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, randomly shooting African-Americans because they didn't like African-Americans. This kind of thing, while extreme, obviously, does put the lie to the idea that we live in a post-racial America. And, the difficulty that some people have acknowledging that we have, not only institutional racism in this country, not only the kind of, quiet, unstated racism that we run into in nice liberal enclaves like Seattle, but also very virulent in-your-face racism in parts of our country as well. It is still a problem, and the sooner we can start honestly talking about it, the sooner we can rather than denying that it exists or trying to sweep it under the rug, the better we can find ways to move beyond it.
All right. Moving on, developments in the Republican side of the upcoming presidential election.
Yeah, well, it was already pretty much mathematically inevitable, but it became official this week. Rick Santorum was squeezed out of the race, so to speak, and actually he put on his campaign on hold, which doesn't sound like an easy thing to do, but what that is, rather than dropping out, that enables him to still raise funds to help retire some of his campaign debts. It's the same thing that Herman Cain did several months ago, as you may recall. And so with Santorum out of the race, Newt Gingrich is still in, but nobody cares. Ron Paul is still in, and a few people care, but only the people who idolize Ron Paul. And so Mitt Romney becomes our de facto nominee. And so watch this week for the beginning of the concerted media effort to shake that Etch-a-Sketch and present Mitt Romney as a moderate, centrist, concerned, rational Republican alternative to Barack Obama. Do not forget all of the extreme things that Mitt Romney has been saying for the last, the last 5 years as he attempts to get the Republican nomination. The I don't care about the poor or the unemployed, the two Cadillacs and the 6 houses and all the different things.
Offshore accounts.
The Swiss bank accounts, and the wanting to abolish funding for Planned Parenthood, his support for the Blunt Amendment, is wanting to dismantle Medicare. All of his radical anti-immigrant policies. You know, all of the things that he said in order to try to convince the most reactionary elements of the Republican Party that he was one of them. Those are all still on YouTube. Those are still out there in the record. And he's going to try his very hardest to pretend he never said them over the next several months. And it's up to us to remember that if he becomes president, he's going to be accountable to that base, and they're going to demand that he implement the policies that he's been espousing for the last several years.
And how long do we get to wait before we hear about the vice presidential pick?
Well, that is up to the candidate in terms of the timing. Often it isn't announced until relatively soon before the actual political conventions at the end of summer. For instance, John McCain announced Sarah Palin a couple of days after actually, it might have even been during the Democratic convention, which was held first in 2008, so as to take some of the media attention away from the Democratic convention. So it's going to be several months yet before Romney announces a running mate.
Okay, and then finally on this subject, with Santorum putting it on hold and so that he can raise more funds, is that more funds from individuals, or are we talking potentially government subsidies of that?
Well, no, that's from individuals, and then also for his super PAC exists separate of that.
Okay. All right. Anything else on that?
Let's move on.
Okay. Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, a couple of regulatory items this week. Goldman Sachs agreed on Thursday to pay federal regulators $22 million to settle accusations that it didn't have adequate policies in place to stop stock research tips from being passed inappropriately to its biggest clients. Now, the deal here was they developed insider analyses based on the information they got, and that was supposed to be held in-house. It wasn't given off in its tip sheets to investors, which often got contradictory advice. So they did their own insider trading. But they also passed along that insider trading information to its biggest clients. Now, this was something that the state of Massachusetts fined Goldman Sachs for $11 million in 2011, or excuse me, $10 million in 2011. So the SEC, the national watchdog, supposedly, for financial misconduct, only fined a couple million dollars more than only about $10 million more than the entire state of Massachusetts did for the same offense. In 2011. And this came the same week that Goldman Sachs announced its first quarter earnings, $12 billion, that's B as in billion, dollars in net revenues in the first quarter of 2012, almost $3 billion in net earnings, that is profits, for the first quarter of 2012. $22 million to federal regulators is a drop in the bucket and certainly not a disincentive for that kind of financial misbehavior.
All right. The Department of Justice also weighing in with a penalty this week.
Yeah, actually not a penalty, but they will pay out in response to a lawsuit. They're going to pay 41 tribes, mostly in the western United States, a little over $1 billion because the Interior and Treasury Departments, in some cases for over the last 100 years, has been failing to oversee concessions on Indian lands from companies that exploit a wide variety of resources, minerals, timber, oil and gas, and drilling rights, and so forth. This is a problem that Native tribes have been complaining about literally for decades, that the federal authorities that control land on reservations or otherwise on tribal lands, they literally will sell off the resources on those lands for pennies on the dollar, and then the tribes will see almost nothing back in return for what in some cases are extremely valuable resources. So this is, again, not full compensation, certainly, especially when you consider a lot of this stuff goes back to the early part of last century and continues up to the present day. But certainly still a significant amount of money, over $1 billion, going to those tribes as a penalty for those lost back earnings.
Well, and potentially extremely devastating operations that occur to extract those.
Yeah, resources. That's now. Again, the $1 billion is just for is just for lost earnings. It isn't even taking into account the environmental damage and degradation
to both the land and the people surrounding
it. Yes, absolutely.
All right. Moving on, the visa being blocked this week.
Yeah, a man named Shahzad Akbar. You may not know the name, and that's because he's not getting any attention in U.S. media, but he is in British and European media. He's a Pakistani lawyer representing civilian victims of drone strike attacks by the United States in Pakistan, has sued the CIA. That's a hearing that, or a lawsuit that's going to get its initial hearing in Islamabad next month. He's trying to come to the United States to attend a conference in Washington, D.C. this month, and the Obama administration is blocking his visa to come to the United States. Will not say why. And this raises a kind of obvious question. If the civilian, if there aren't any civilian deaths due to drone strikes, and in fact, the drone strike program itself does not officially exist, which the Obama administration has claimed in court in response to attempted lawsuits here, then what's the problem? What kind of threat does this guy represent? But instead, again, it is an attempt by the Obama administration to have the United States citizenry know as little as possible, both about the drone program, the civilian deaths due to the drone program, and the stories of those people who have died. And the U.S. media is going right along. I came across this in British media. I haven't seen anything about it in the United States media at all.
So he must be coming to the conference on drones.
Yes, he is. That's happening in Washington, D.C. in a couple weeks.
All right.
He's hoping to come anyway.
Yeah,
it's
trying
not clear whether he's going to be able to make it or not.
Sure. Okay. And then finally on national, the Maricopa County, former Maricopa County attorney.
Yeah, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who is the notorious sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona, which is where about 4 million people in Phoenix and suburbs live. His closest ally, a former county attorney named Andrew Thomas, was disbarred this week. A state panel there, and also his chief aide was also disbarred. A state panel ruling that they abused their powers as a prosecutor in their office to target their and Arpaio's political enemies. This is something people there have been complaining about for a number of years, and it really represents yet another official attempt to hold Arpaio and the people he has surrounded himself with accountable, and really with a federal investigation into Arpaio's civil liberties and civil rights violations going on, that empire is due to crumble pretty soon.
All
good
right.
News.
Moving on to international, starting with Syria.
Yeah, major demonstrations in Syria yesterday on the second day of a UN-mandated ceasefire. At least 8 people dead. The largest demonstrations in some months there. The UN peacekeepers have not arrived in Syria yet. Russia blocking deployment yesterday over details of the scope of their duties and what their actual powers would be in Syria. Russia, of course, being the major international power that has been backing the Syrian regime and continuing to sell them weapons and arms. Hopefully, the ceasefire will hold in Syria, but a lot of international figures not optimistic about it, so it's clear this is going to keep going for a while.
All right. And Iran.
Talks start today in Istanbul between Iran and the European powers in the United States over nuclear disarmament. And good news on this front, Iran signaling in pre-talks with envoys from Russia and China this week their willingness to trade limits on enrichment for uranium in exchange for relief on the economic sanctions that President Obama has sanctioned and that he and the European Union have imposed, which are inflicting real damage on the Iranian economy. If Iran is serious about that kind of willingness, nothing is likely to come out of this weekend's talks in Istanbul per se, but they do represent an opportunity for talks as moving forward and down the road. And this again is something that is being talked about in in European and British media, but is not being talked about in American media, where positive signs from the Iranian regime in terms of negotiations are simply not taken seriously. And nothing's taken seriously unless it comes from the U.S. government. And then again, we talk here about how Iranian state-controlled media is unreliable and can't be trusted. Well, the same thing can be said about state-controlled media in this country, only the state doesn't control the media. The media controls itself on behalf of the state, or something like that.
I was going to say, I mean, when you're saying nuclear disarmament, for a second there, I was like, oh, is the U.S. going to discuss nuclear disarmament here in the U.S.?
No, we wouldn't. We wouldn't possibly do that, because our nukes are fine. It's just those irresponsible countries that threaten invading other countries, which the United States has never actually done, that are considered dangerous and unacceptable.
All right.
That's snark for anybody keeping score at home.
Yeah, those of you getting the video feed. We've seen the word snark come up.
Yes.
All right, well, we still have a few minutes left, but we have plenty of events to talk about.
Yeah, Rachel Maddow coming into town today. She will be at Town Hall this afternoon at 4 o'clock. That is talking about her latest book. That is a $5 admission, but I would advise
getting there
early.
I heard it was sold out.
May very well be sold
website.
Out. I didn't.
So that's...
I didn't see that on the website I looked at, but it's very possible.
Unless
so
you can
somebody,
push your way in.
Somebody may be scalping tickets outside.
That would be interesting.
But she will be in town this afternoon. Tomorrow is the day for the Democratic caucuses, in case you want to vote for Barack Obama or an alternative to Barack Obama. But perhaps more importantly, since that part of it is a foregone conclusion, there will be a push in the platform at the local and then eventually at the state and national level to try and get the Democrats to embrace marriage equality as part of their platform. This is not something that the Democratic Party has embraced. It's not something that Barack Obama as president has gotten behind yet, and they're overdue.
Talk about that a little bit more, because I, having actually participated in that years ago, it's actually an interesting process where you can go to your local community caucuses and bring forward proposed law.
Every neighborhood has a different caucus, and the Republicans had theirs a couple months ago. The Democrats are having theirs this weekend on Sunday, and you can look it up online and go to your neighborhood. There's usually several precincts that have their caucuses in one place. It's usually a school or a church. And you caucus for your preferred presidential candidates. I've never been to one where there was only one on the ballot. I can't imagine there'll be much suspense this time, although if you want to push for an alternative to Barack Obama, I'm sure there'll be a lot of old Obama supporters who'll be open to that. Mm-hmm. But you also get a chance to debate platform resolutions. Go into the platform. And there's also a nominating process for people to go on to the next levels of caucuses as delegates. So, I think there's an interim step that then you eventually get to county, caucuses and then state. And, eventually you wind up with the delegates to the national convention, which will be in Charlotte this year. A lot of those delegates are not professional party operatives. They're ordinary people who come to these caucuses and make a case for why they should go to the next level, and people vote them in. It actually is a fairly open and democratic process on both the Democratic and Republican Party sides, and it's I've done it a couple times. It's pretty interesting and I think well worth your while to check out. If you've never done it before.
You get to see how sausage is made. So.
Absolutely. And it is in fact repulsive, as sausage making often is, but it's an interesting kind of repulsive.
I just see it as something that everyone should participate in at least once in their life.
Yeah, yeah. And for all the carping that we do on this program about the compromises that have been made to the democratic process in this country and how it's been corrupted by money and corporations and so forth, ordinary people can still make a difference. And you can't make a difference unless you try.
All right. A couple more events still.
Yeah. Tuesday is tax day. It's not actually on the 15th this year, because the 15th is on a weekend and the 16th is an official holiday in the District of Columbia. And so it got moved to Tuesday the 17th this year. And there will be several different protests going on around town, mostly leafleting in area post offices, mostly because people haven't figured out yet that people don't go to post offices on the tax day anymore. They file electronically. But you got to go somewhere, right? So they go to the post offices and leaflet and talk about military spending and all kinds of other ugly spending that goes on in the federal budget. and where your tax dollars actually go. So the Fellowship of Reconciliation is one of the primary groups that's behind that, and you can go to their website and see which post offices they will be at. And then Wednesday, April 18th, is another annual day. It's the Day of Silence. This has been going on for a number of years now. It's a nationwide day where students stay silent all day to support safer schools for all, regardless of sexual orientation. It's become a big deal and a very successful day. So if you are a secondary or college student and want to participate, all it takes is to not speak out.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State's online at www.eatthestate.org. And Maria, when she is here, she'll be back next week, hopefully. She also publishes both there and on her own website at www.mariatomchik.com.